Hey. I'll turn the volume down. And it's September 11th, 2003, and I'm Andrea Meisterwan with Yixin Jing. See, I'm never going to get that right. And for the last session of her Pew Scholars program in the Biomedical Sciences Oral History Interview. And I wanted to pick up, just follow up on a couple of questions from things we talked about yesterday. And one of them was, you have worked with fungus, flies, frogs, humans, HeLa cells, Drosophila, and I'm forgetting one, mouse. So,
yeast.
Okay, and how important is model organism choice in the work that you do?
It's very important. Okay. You know, certain aspect of a question is easier to be addressed in certain organism with certain approach. So, for example, the recent project my student has now finished is that she started to use Xenopus egg extract to address the question of whether a protein, very interesting protein complex, is involved in regulating spindle disassembly at the end of mitosis. And she was able to establish that function of this protein. And then, you know, it's really important to also see if this protein complex has a conserved role, and also whether it indeed function in vivo. You know, in biology, everybody always worry about, okay, whatever you see using in vitro assays, whether that's really just a in vitro artifact, even though Xenopus egg extract have been well received as being something mimicking in vivo function, but people still worry. So then in terms of addressing in vivo function of a protein, she decided to use the yeast, and that allowed her to do various genetic analysis, and basically led to the same kind of result.
Well, what impact has it had that you have used Xenopus as a model, and because of the tetraploidy problem, it looks like that genome won't be sequenced anytime soon.
That's really slowing things down for people like us. You know, if we want to identify a protein, using biochemistry, we would like to, you know, identify sets of proteins by purifying the protein subject to microsequencing. Since we don't have a genome backing us, we don't know the sequence of all the protein, we often, you know, have to be lucky that this stretch of peptide we sequenced happened to have a homolog in mammals. Then we would say, okay, maybe from the information in mammals, we can easily design PCR primers to clone the Xenopus gene. Oftentimes, we actually are able to generate peptides, but there's no homology anywhere. Now this protein basically, just you'll have to use hard way to clone it if you really, really want to clone it. So it's been a big impediment.
Right, and why is that it's been so slow or there's not enough, you certainly aren't the first Pew Scholar to use frogs, why has that been?
Yeah, I think it has something to do with that, even though frogs has been very popular in cell cycle research, like what we do, cell division research, and also in development, but the population of scientists who are studying it, I think, is not as big as compared to other organisms. That's one factor. The other factor is it's a tetraploid.
Yeah.
So that makes sequencing daunting. Yeah. That's the other reason. I think it's two issues that made it difficult.
Right. Okay. And how do you see this, the lack of the genome, how do you see that influencing future decisions on what model to use?
Well, I think people like me, who really want to study certain aspects of cell division, would still have to use Xenopus egg extracts. Like it did, for example, affected the decision I make in terms of what to do. you know, we've tried to identify protein complexes using Xenopus egg extract, and we have basically end up only focusing on the proteins that has conserved function or has been found in other organisms to study their function in Xenopus, using their specific function during cell division, instead of focusing on proteins that really were not sharing, were not having any homology in other systems. Because we found that very risky, time consuming. You know, you can, you know, clone the Xenopus gene, and then you'll have to, you know, take the risk of what if this gene really is just not really involved what you're studying. Because we got it by biochemical purification. We didn't get it through function. So, you know, it did sort of, it has been limiting our, you know, how we would, I mean, we would just avoid those genes that have not been shown up in mammalian, you know, human sequence database. If it's not showing up, we would just not, that would not be our first choice.
Yeah. Okay. And because you have used so many, you know, you have had experience using different model organisms, what benefits does that give you in this new area of research in evolution and comparative evolution?
I think it's, excuse me, I think it's really beneficial, you know, from a cell biological point of view. You see that the cell, depending on what type of cell you're working with, seem to have evolved somewhat different way of solving the same problem. So when you think about evolution, you would be probably, your thinking probably would be less limited. You would think, well, this is a possibility because it happens in other situations. Evolved, this kind of phenomena evolved in this kind of cells. It could have happened, it could also happen in this other cell if you, you know, uncoupled or recoupled certain regulatory circuitry that would happen. So that, I think it's really useful.
Yeah. Okay. And some people might argue that, you know, having, you know, experience with all these different models, you end up being a jack of all trades and a master of none. Is there a risk to...
No. I think, you know, I don't believe I mastered all the model organisms. Mm-hmm. I just basically, for a specific biological question, mm-hmm. I decide to use certain model organisms. That's it. I've never been model organism driven. I've always been question problem driven.
Yeah.
So
okay.
It's that's not a problem.
Yeah. Okay. Well, also, again, to touch on something we talked about yesterday is, you know, early in your career, you were using brute force screenings. You were creating huge cDNA libraries. How has technology impacted the training of students and particularly the kinds of skills that graduate students and postdocs now learn?
Oh, it's a huge impact. For example, they don't have to sequence anything anymore, and usually don't make their own libraries anymore.
Right.
And it just, I think now students these days really have to be more, spending more time in thinking about a problem than, you know, trying to weed through all the technical things before they can get to solve a problem. So I think that's a big change. I think students come to a lab, you immediately get, whatever they do, they immediately get to they can quickly get to a stage of actually answer a question instead of having to, okay, let's just clone the gene, let's just sequence it, let's just, it's just much faster.
So technology has helped move beyond boring science, would
you
say?
I think technology has made things a lot more interesting. You can do things really a lot more faster. Well, that also makes it more competitive.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So.
And how about hands skills at the bench?
It's still very important.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you still have to be able to go from X to Y to Z. You have to still have to be able to do experiments to show whatever theory you have is correct or incorrect.
Yeah.
You will never overcome that, no matter how fast technology is advancing. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Okay, well, one area we haven't talked about is funding. Mm-hmm. And I know from your CV that you currently have one.
R01, yes.
Yeah, and I'm going to say that was renewed because it seems, yeah. Okay, so how successful have you been? I guess just to talk about kind of the history of your funding, when you arrived at Carnegie, what did you have to start up with?
Well, just, you know, our chairman's word, you'll get what you need.
Okay.
That's what we have. We all, I mean, that's a Carnegie style. You know, there isn't a set amount, but you do tend to get what you need. If what you need is really sound and reasonable, you essentially get what you need.
Yeah, to start up.
Yeah.
And then what percentage of your salary is covered by Carnegie and what percent by grants?
Well, now it doesn't. It's irrelevant because I also have Harry Hughes Medical.
Right. Okay.
Institution appointments, so all my salary is covered by Harry Hughes.
Okay.
So Carnegie does not cover my salary, nor my grant.
Okay. Yeah. And how easy or difficult was it to get your first R01?
I don't think it was hard in the sense of you know. I wrote it and I got it. It wasn't hard. But I think, you know, to actually get your first R01, you basically have to do well as a postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
You have to show as a postdoc you have established an area that wasn't something everybody else was already there, and you can continue along that area, and that's what you have to do. Once you achieve that, I think your first R01 is really easy.
Yeah.
That's exactly how I feel, at least in my field. And my friends who got, I don't see anybody has trouble getting R01.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's good because that's, you know, science has written a few articles about how difficult it is for young investigators to get their first R01.
I think it really depends on the field.
Yeah.
My field in general is pretty small, microtubule field is pretty small, so you usually get trained, you know, during your training, you know, you still have the opportunity to explore a new horizon, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know for sure these days. I mean, we are talking about 7 years ago.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's the situation now. I think it's probably a lot more difficult because of the budget cut and the downturn of the economy and everything.
Right. Well, when you were leaving the Alberts lab, what were the issues involved in taking your project?
There wasn't any issue because Spruce wasn't there.
Yeah.
I never really felt that was a big deal because I think in my mind, I never paid attention to, well, what else other people might want to do. I was pretty much single-minded looking at, this is what I want to do. And, you know, during I was purifying Gamma Turk, I knew there must be competition, but that rarely crossed my mind. What if somebody else get ahead of me? Those kind of things kind of didn't cross my mind that much. And in terms of whether I'm going to take this project or not, again, it was the issue of, I felt, you know, you cannot stay with one project forever. You have to branch out. I think I probably, due to my intrinsic tendency of wanting to do something different all the time, made it less of an issue for me. I just didn't think it was a big deal. But, you know, I think in general, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
When postdoc leave their mentor's lab, and usually I think mentors give 2-year grace period. Sometimes things becomes very gray. What if this postdoc did something, that postdoc also did something, they overlapped unknowingly, and then later realize, oh, okay, it's a low overlap, you know, you start from 2 point, it crosses. And if one left for a job, the other one is still in the lab, what do you do?
Yeah.
So it's, I think it's really complicated. It's a very complicated issue.
Right.
I think the best way to approach that, to deal with it, is just, you know, just to work out a certain agreement to say, okay, define the thing you want to do. This is what I want to do. This is what you want to do. Let's give each other a certain grace period of time. And after that, there's no limitation. I think the worst thing is, I'm going to take this whole project, this whole area. Nobody in your lab can touch it. I think that's the worst thing.
Yeah.
And there have been things like that in science I've heard of. And that's just, to me, it's ridiculous. You can never claim a whole field. And preventing your former lab to work on it doesn't mean that other people won't scoop you.
Yeah, right.
So...
Well, how have you dealt with this with your own students? Have you had to deal with these issues?
With my two postdocs, yes.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, the way my approach is, you tell me what you want to work on. You tell me various aspects you want to work on this part. I'm not going to say I will stop working on spindle assembly mitosis. It's not possible. Or this whole RAM pathway. I can't say that, but there are definitely... areas I can guarantee if you want to do it, I won't do it. Mm. So that's how we work up.
Yeah, I
think it's that's the problem in science, I think. But usually it's a temporary problem. When people leave, after people start their own lab for a year or two, if they are going to be surviving, they realize the fight is not what particular project. I mean, that's what I realized.
Mm-hmm.
It's really your imagination and creativity that's going to allow you to survive in being a scientist.
Yeah.
Not whether your old lab will continue to work on certain aspect of it or not. That's my view, but you know, people may actually disagree with me.
Yeah. So in the life cycle of a scientist, your students have not become competitors? Direct competitors?
Not really. I mean, they if they say this is something they want to work on, I don't work on it.
Okay.
It hasn't been a direct competition. I think if you really say, okay, this is the protein I want to work on, I don't work on it.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be a problem.
Okay. And for yourself, coming out of the Alberts lab and having
it wasn't an issue. There was a little bit of an issue, but really in the end, not much of a deal. So there was a postdoc in Bruce's lab who sort of worked on different things. I purified gamma turmeric, and she was studying centrosome. So, you know, it wasn't really much of a problem. Bruce said, why don't you have her, you know, clone some genes so it would push things faster. So she started to clone some genes of this complex, but in the end she got bogged down to do something she's more interested in doing. It didn't amount to much of a problem. And then she went to Dave Eggert's lab, and you know, there she helped Dave Eggert to work on this complex. But they took a structural point of view, and that's not my forte. So it's I've been there, done that. I felt when you are a postdoc, especially when you are looking at leaving the lab, establish your own lab, it's really understandable that you're very nervous and you are being more territorial. That's a very understandable phenomenon. But I don't think anyone can ever claim the reason my career didn't take off is because my PI kept competing with me.
Mm.
That I would never agree.
Okay.
Because there's no way you would survive anyway if you're not smart enough, creative enough,
okay,
to realize, okay, my PI is too interested in this problem,
mm-hmm,
and he had a bigger lab, I'm going to have to switch to something else. If it's not your PI, it would be somebody else who's very smart in your field who roll you over. Mm-hmm. So I really don't agree with those kind of mumbling, those kind of whiny thing.
Yeah.
I think science is not something, you know, oh, if somebody took this thing, then
that's the end of my career. Mm. It's never that way. You have to really believe your own ability to identify a new problem, to study it. There's so many interesting problems in biology. Why does it have to be some certain problem there that you have to study so you will have a career? I don't agree.
Okay, great, great. Okay, well, back to the funding issue. How, what's the optimal size you want your lab to be, and how many, how much money, how many grants does that take?
Okay, I think probably. Well, I've been switching back and forth. I think let's just say, you know, if I get to have people who are, if I get to have half, okay, if I get to have an 8-people lab, then if 2 of those are very independent, very good, I can manage it. But if I get to have 12-sized lab, then, you know, 4 of them or even more of them would have to be more independent so that you can actually run your lab and you can be productive. So I don't think there is an answer to the size that I would feel comfortable. It all depends on how good the people you have are, how independent they are, how much you need to have daily supervision, I think. Mm-hmm. And in terms of running the lab, I think if you have 8-people lab, and it's again hard question, because if you are able to recruit people who can apply for their fellowships, then it's less money. But if you aren't able to do that, then it's a whole lot more money. So I don't know. I can't give you an answer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, would you want a lab that's, you trained in your graduate work, you trained in a lab that was relatively small.
Very small.
And the Albert's lab
is a 12. It started with 12 and then ended up with nothing.
Right.
By the
right.
time I left, it was probably only 4 or 6. I don't remember.
Yeah, and the Mitchison lab, I would imagine, was large as well.
It was about 16.
Yeah, okay. So is that, you know, do you aspire to a
highly high-profile, productive lab like Albert's or, you know, Mitchison? Or
I mean, everybody, when they first start their career, they would love to have that. After 7 years, I realized what it takes to have that.
What does
and
it take?
What does it take is that you have to have people who are very good in order to run a big lab. Mm-hmm. If you don't have people who are self-sufficient, you cannot run a big lab, because if you do that, you'll completely be bogged down. Or most people in your lab will be floundering. Only a few. Then maybe what you would do is then you focus on the ones who are producing and give them a lot of advice and supervision, and the ones who is just not producing, you just ignore. That could be wrong, but then you still have to support the whole huge lab, so you have to spend a lot of time writing grants and things like that. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's, you know, yeah, of course, if I get to have all these smart people who want to come work with me, then it's worth my time to write the grants to support them so they will develop a novel approach. And it'd be exciting for me. I can be a manager. I don't mind to be a manager in that case, because I get to hear the exciting ideas and the exciting results. But that's generally not the case, especially since I started my career, because I think the explosion of biology has stopped before. You know, I think probably at the end of my graduate school or middle part of my graduate school. So from there on, it's just downhill. Less and less people want to continue this route, and less postdocs there are out there.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, it's just it's a pyramid thing, right? If in the beginning, when there were very few biology labs and there's a ton of money, everybody is able to, you know, it's great for a new student to see this huge, great future to go into biology. So it attracted a lot of smart people, and they attracted a lot of smart graduate students and postdocs. And most of them got jobs. So they got jobs, they got money to hire people, but you cannot possibly sustain this expansion. I think it went to the expansion, now it's going like that.
Yeah.
And I think people from probably even before my generation hit this. So I just don't think it's, unless you have you are extremely smart, have really established some unique area that made your name, that people want to go work with you. It's possible. It's still possible, but I think it becomes much more difficult. I mean, if you work on some popular area that's currently hyped up,
yeah,
then it's possible you'll get that. I definitely, whatever I work on is never really a hyped up area. So
yeah,
I can't possibly run a business.
Yeah. Okay. And how well, you know, given that Carnegie Institution here is somewhat attached to the university, but not really part integrated into the university, how successful have you been in attracting, you know, good and capable and smart graduate students and postdocs and technicians?
I think I've been pretty lucky with graduate students. Not in number, but in quality. I've had 3 graduate students. All of them are great. And 2 graduated. They went to Harvard, and they're doing well. One is going to graduate next year. She's wonderful, very smart, very bright.
And so where do your graduate students come from?
Biology department.
Okay.
Yeah, they're generous enough to let us dig into their pool of graduate students. I think we're going to become even more integrated
when you move to your new building. That's
well, even now, because
okay,
they start to, you know, allow us to have first rotation with students,
okay,
and stuff like that. Postdoc, no, I haven't had a great fortune. I think, I don't really know what's the deal here. I think it's a combination of being in Baltimore,
okay,
and also in what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Baltimore is not a premier place for postdoc.
Okay, and why is that? You would think with the Hopkins being here.
I know, but you know, you have Bay Area.
Yeah.
You have Boston area.
Right, okay.
You have San Diego. So, you know, well, I was choosing postdoc. I only looked, my eyes are mostly focused on either Boston or Bay Area.
Right.
Because I figure, you know, I will only be there for 4 years. Why not just find a place where you can feel the excitement?
Yeah.
Whereas here in Baltimore, you can hardly feel that. And especially at Carnegie, it's so small. Carnegie really attracts certain type of people to come.
Yeah, okay. Well, so how, if so rotations are just, Carnegie's now just becoming part of
it's
the
more
laboratory.
Integrated.
Yeah.
Before,
well,
the first rotation was only, so the first rotation the students did before were only limited in biology, and then the last 3, they are allowed to go out.
Okay.
Now they are allowing them to go right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
okay.
I think the faculties here are contributing more and more in graduate teaching. That probably helps as well.
Yes. Yeah. So how would you get to, before this change, how were you able to get graduate students attracted to your work? How?
I don't know. They just read.
Okay.
I think that you get to present students.
Okay.
And then they read your thing. I think just, for example, I know if the students were like me, they would be like me. Probably most of them are much more sophisticated than I was, but at least when they read your stuff, they have to say, well, this makes sense to me. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, there are so many interesting science out there, so it's competitive. In fact, I want to be able to recruit 1 or 2 students in my lab this year. I don't know. I didn't get anyone to their first rotation in my lab. I'm kind of nervous.
Yeah.
I want to, I mean, you know, it's, I don't know. You really need people.
Yeah. And how good are the Hopkins graduate students in the biology department?
I have to say, in the 7 years I've been here, they are just, their quality is been rising.
Okay.
I was very lucky. The first student I had turned out to be great. The second was great. Third is even greater. So
Yeah.
Speak with.
And do you get any students interested in your work from the medical campus?
Not really. Nobody contacted me. It would be nice if I could dig into their pool, but they would never allow us.
Oh, why is that?
Well, it's all competitive, right?
Okay.
I mean, we all compete for the limited pool of students and postdocs.
Okay.
So when you have cultivated a pool, you want to guard it.
Okay. Well, and how well have you been able to attract, you know, good and competent technicians?
I have been lucky again. So, I mean, I inherited a technician who's really good, who's long-term. She worked with another staff member here who left to go to my clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So she came, she actually worked for 2 years. With a staff associate, you know, those are temporary positions here.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I joined, she came to my lab. So she's been with me as long as I've been here. And then I tend to hire sort of short-term, not exactly short-term, I had, after, you know, I hired another technician for 3 years. She then went back to China. And now I had another technician. She turned out to be really good as well. And she also, after probably 3-4 years, she'll go back to China.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been, and I think I have not really had a great luck in terms of getting right out of college type of students.
Mm-hmm.
A few people tried, one really good one basically left after half a year to graduate school, so that wasn't very useful. So for those students, you tend to get about a year worth, or 2 years worth of, if you get them for 2 years, you should really consider yourself lucky. But in those 2 or 1 years, you have to, they need to be trained for half a year, so it's
yeah.
less stable.
Yeah,
that's where a lot of people getting technicians from.
Yeah, and how competitive is the pool of technicians here in Baltimore, would you say?
I don't think it's easy to get a very good technician.
Okay.
It's actually very hard to get a very good technician.
Mm-hmm.
You can always find people who can't work, but
uh-huh.
a really good, responsible one is very hard to find. Or well-trained, basically know all the techniques, and, you know, is very reliable, dependable, wouldn't say, well, I can't come. You know, it's just very hard. I've been very lucky.
Yeah, and how important, you know, what's the balance you need in your lab to get the work done between technicians, grad students, and postdocs?
I think because I don't have a big lab, and also Carnegie is set up in such a way, the technical help is really greatly minimized, like
okay.
the really mundane, like ordering of really very commonly used stuff is not technician's job, because
okay.
it's ordered by the department. Restriction enzyme, plasticware, a lot of other, you know, daily use materials ordered by the department.
Okay.
So technicians really get to do a lot of experiments. In that case, then, you know, I would say I really only need 1.5 technicians.
Mm-hmm.
If, yeah, 1.5. One is kind of hard.
Mm-hmm.
1.5 is good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, funding, particularly, you seem to have been fairly successful in, you know, Carnegie is clearly an endowment, Howard Hughes is an endowment, Pew Scholars is an endowment, and I don't know how the Carnegie Endowment's doing, but I know that the Pew Trust and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute has taken a big hit in the last couple of years, and both
Carnegie has been doing fine.
Yeah, downscaling. How confident are you? Are you an assistant professor with the Howard Hughes? Is that?
I'm an assistant investigator. Yeah.
And how confident are you that you'll be able to maintain your appointment with the?
I think I should be able to get renewed once.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident that next renewal I should get it, because, you know, in the 5 years I've been appointed, we've made a really exciting findings along, you know, the line that I started. We not only really forwarded the pathway that we figured out at the beginning of Howard Hughes, we really figured out several steps down from the beginning. that's when I was appointed. And not only that, we actually branched out into a new direction of another very exciting area. So I don't have, I'm not worried about that. I think I'm more, my concern is more like myself, like, okay, I feel like even though we have been studying things that's exciting, you know, I just feel it's just, if, I mean, I often ask myself, if I'm not there, somebody else can do it, then it's not that exciting. So I feel I'm not satisfied with my whole performance in terms of a scientist. I felt I haven't really done anything that's truly original. Mm. And that's something more of my concern. I've been very, and that just makes me also feel, I mean, you know, I like what I'm doing. I enjoy, you know, figuring out those things. I think it's still important. But I've always had this feeling, if I'm not there, somebody else is going to get it done. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I tend to be easily getting bored. I think maybe that's a manifestation of I'm kind of getting bored. Mm. And I know I was definitely getting bored. And I don't know whether the reason is because, you know, I felt like I haven't done anything that important or anything. I don't know.
What's the criteria of, you know, doing something important? When
something
will you achieve
that? If you don't do it, it probably wouldn't be that obvious. Other people probably wouldn't have done it. I don't know. I mean, it's hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, any idea, once it's starting to be talked about, you know, I don't know. Mm. I don't know. Maybe it's really, I have been, or it's also possible it's midlife crisis.
Oh, okay.
That's another possibility.
Are you having a midlife crisis?
I think I already passed that.
Okay.
I think the last 2 years was very, very hard. It was just like, what am I doing? Where am I doing all of this? I think I already passed that.
How did you work out of that?
I think one way was to really start to, you know, the evolutionary project and reading into evolution and really trying to get my mind away from various things you can never solve, but into certain things that's quite interesting intellectually. Mm. I think evolution is intellectually an interesting question. The main thing that attracted me is I think there isn't any clear idea yet what at all happened. Why we suddenly have such a diversity? People all have their own ideas. None of those ideas are proven. Nobody has a really good way to study it. I think that, to me, is really interesting and exciting.
Yeah. Okay. So how many R01s do you think you would...
I really only need one.
To maintain the lab at the levels that you want to maintain.
Yeah, well, I mean, Carnegie has size limit.
Yeah.
We're allowed to have about 8, plus minus 2.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And why is there a size limit?
I think this is the idea, the ideals of this institution, where it really encourages PI to be scientists, not becoming managers.
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, most PIs here, probably everybody, does research themselves, have their pet projects, just work on.
Yeah.
Also, I think, I don't know, I think that probably is the most important reason.
Do you have something here called, like, tenure?
No, we don't have tenure. Okay. So I don't have tenure with Carnegie, I don't have tenure with biology, I don't have tenure with HHMI, or Hughes Medical
Institution. Right,
so
right.
I knew that when I was making my choices. I felt really comfortable 5 years ago, or 7 years ago, when I was deciding where I was going to go. I think last 2 years, there were times I was thinking, well, maybe I have made a wrong choice. Maybe I should go to a place where I could get a tenure. Then if I really ran out of my excitement in doing research, I still have a job.
Okay.
Now it's less of a problem, because now I feel, I think if I'm bored with science, I probably would want to be staying in science without doing research, because it would bore me. So I probably would do something else. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So
okay.
I sort of come to terms with it.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Well, what difference does it make? You have with the kind and the type of science that you do, when money comes either from public sources of funding like the National Institutes of Health or private sources of funding like the HHMI or
oh,
Pew.
Oh, HHMI, Pew are very important for me because
okay.
I tend to do different things. And with NIH, if you don't make progress in whatever you propose you want to do, you'll go down. You won't get funding. So I think the initial thing to get Pew was really important for me to get moving to RAND. That allowed me to hire that postdoc to come in and work on, you know, some project that's different. And Hughes definitely also allowed me to really think about, I think getting Hughes, and probably not just getting Hughes, being at Carnegie, getting Hughes, all made me think, well, I'm endowed on three, I've been given money from these endowments. All of them have this idea of having you do something different. I think maybe that was also one reason that made me unsettled with what I've been doing. I feel like I haven't done something truly original, although I've been lucky enough to get all this foundation money. So I think maybe that was also a driving force to make me really want to do something different.
Yeah, okay. Well, yesterday we talked a little bit about, you discussed a little bit about the problems of your field, and the kinds of projects it takes to get to be productive, that they're long-term projects, and you felt like there may be some danger in that this field, because there's so few people and it's so difficult that people then move out of the field, that it will disappear. What's the impact if the current situation doesn't allow for long-term projects?
I think what people have been doing is just like me have been doing is, you know, what the impact you mean? So
well, besides the extinction kind of quotient.
Well, the impact would be that, for example, for me,
yeah.
I can't say for other people. For me, I know we worked out one assay that we took. There was assay that was worked out by other people. We were able to take this assay and then do biochemistry. We made three steps. But after that, it was hard, and my postdoc tried very hard. I know he had made a lot of effort. I know he would need a paper when he's from Japan. He wants to go back to Japan. He needs a paper. So basically, after 2 years, I said, okay, well, a year and a half, I said, okay, let's just take a candidate approach and to be sure that you're going to get a paper. So we sort of just decided to, instead of following that purification, which probably will take somebody 5 years, could be still with no paper, or could be you could get something more exciting. We decided, okay, you will go with a sort of lesser, cut your goal down, back down to be more paper-oriented. So now he has a paper. But, you know, that assay, that purification is just staying there. Nobody else is touching it. I mean, I tend to have postdoc work on completely different projects.
Mm-hmm.
So because I don't want them to have tension among each other. It's uncomfortable. So I, you know, essentially I'll have to wait until somebody who has this kind of aptitude or this kind of ability to do protein purification, hardcore protein purification and really difficult protein purification, and willing to give it a try to do it. So I don't know when it's going to come. And then at the same time, I realize I still need to get papers, still need to make reasonable progresses. Even if it's not groundbreaking, it needs to be progress. So I just have other people to work on something that's sort of more obvious, at least you'll get a paper, even if you don't make a groundbreaking discovery. But you could still make a, you know, fundamental discovery for that area. So that's what I've been trying to do. You just manage. You sort of push it a little bit. You push it, and then step back and do something else, get a paper. And then you go back and push again. Or you go to a different direction to push it.
Yeah.
And that's what people have been doing. And maybe that's really what science should be. You can't just be so narrow-minded to only go in one route. You have to go from different directions.
Yeah. Okay, let me flip the tape over.